Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
All right, so I'm Bart Everson, and I'm sitting here today with Dr. David Robinson Morris on the sixth floor here at Xavier University of Louisiana, the sixth floor of this office. I think this is the office maybe where I first met you a few years ago. And, you know, a lot of things have been happening since then that I thought we should really sit down with David and record an interview for our podcast. And then I heard that you had your book come out.
Yeah.
So on top of everything else, this new book, Ubuntu and Buddhism in Higher Education, I thought, okay, this is the perfect time, the perfect opportunity to actually get to it and speak with you. So for our listeners who may not know who you are, where you come from, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure.
And, of course, there's other things going on campus here that you're doing now. We'll get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
But just kind of your background.
Yeah. So I am originally from Galveston, Texas, so I'm not a native New Orleanian, although New Orleans gets in your blood and in your soul. So I like to tell people that I wasn't born here physically, but I was born here spiritually, right? So in that way, I am a New Orleanian. I went to Loyola right down the street, undergrad. Worked there after undergrad. I worked for the mayor for a little bit after undergrad. Right after Katrina, I worked for Nagin as a senior publicist, in all of the areas critical to the rebuilding, which was quite a time and quite an interesting time in the city. At the request of our then university president, I came back to Loyola to be the associate director of alumni relations, a job that was supposed to last for 6 months to helped me de-stress from the stressfulness of working in city government, lasted 4.5 years, which I loved. Loyola was like going home for me. So it was a good thing. Left Loyola, went over to New Beginnings, the Charter Schools Network, and worked there as the director of development. In the middle of all of that, got a master's degree at UNO in public administration, thinking that I was going to go back into political communications at some point. I work in higher education, so in some ways I'm still back in political communications. What else did I do? Eventually left there, went to go work for Newman for the director of development for a small program there called Breakthrough, which helps middle school students academically accelerate to get into high-performing high schools, which was wonderful. It was a great time. And then started my PhD program at LSU. So I have a PhD from LSU in educational leadership and research with focuses in curriculum theory and higher education administration. That's a little bit about me. I'm also pretty civically involved. I'm one of the founding members of Propeller here in town. Yes, which is a social entrepreneurship incubator of sorts. I was a founding board member for that organization. I was part of the organization that predated it, which is CINO, that it was born out of.
The Committee for a Better New Orleans?
No, that's a different CINO now. That's literally a CINO. This one was S-E-N-O, Social Entrepreneurs of New Orleans, which is what Propeller was born out of. So that and it's thriving. It's in year 10 or something like that. So I'm very happy with that. I'm now an emeritus board member. I don't serve on that board anymore for a number of reasons, most of all because I'm way too busy. I'm also the incoming chair for Emerging Philanthropists of New Orleans. And we try to foster a sense of philanthropy among our 20 to 40 year olds in the city, and help them become philanthropically engaged.
Aren't you on some kind of human rights thing too?
That too, Bart. So I serve on the City of New Orleans Human Relations Commission. And I'm the co-chair of what we're now calling the Truth and Reconciliation Subcommittee, which is handling how we think about public spaces. and the renaming of public spaces and what will replace or not replace the Confederate monuments that have been taken down. So we're in the process now of developing a framework to make those decisions, which is really interesting work.
That's great. Well, I've got some thoughts on that, but I'll save that for another time.
I want to hear.
I'll save that for another time. I did see on the way, on the bike ride to campus this morning, I did see that somebody's put a Christmas wreath on the General Pike, the statue of General Pike that's still up on the neutral ground there of the parkway. But that's another story. There's so much to talk about. Let's get into this new book. It's brand new.
Brand new.
Hot off the press.
Yeah.
Ubuntu and Buddhism in Higher Education, subtitled An Ontological Rethinking, parenthetical re.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm holding one of the few copies available here on campus in my hands now. I've been looking over an electronic PDF of it. So perhaps it's a little premature to talk to you yet, because, of course, I haven't really read the book in every word. I've been skimming over it. But this is not a light, easy bedtime read.
No.
It's kind of some heavy stuff
with
a big scope. Now, I love this kind of thing. But I feel a little bit foolish almost trying to talk to you about the book. So we're going to have to kind of look at the big picture. Yeah. But that's really kind of the whole purpose of the book is looking at the big picture.
Yes.
It is a very kind of holistic perspective.
Yes.
Yes. You're looking at, obviously, from the title, Ubuntu and Buddhism, two concepts with which a lot of readers, if they're familiar with one, they're probably not going to be familiar with the other.
Right.
Right. I know a little bit about Buddhism, just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
But about Ubuntu, I know virtually nothing.
Yeah.
Right. Because to me, it was just is the name of an operating system.
Right.
The Linux operating system, which I knew came from an African concept.
Mm-hmm.
But skimming the chapter on that, I realized there's a lot more to it than just. In fact, it's one of these untranslatable words.
Yes.
Say untranslatable into a Western context.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about some of the big ideas in this book. Ubuntu might be a good starting place.
Yeah. So Ubuntu, if you know about the South African anti-apartheid movement, right, you know about Ubuntu because it was undergirded with this what we call a philosopraxis, a philosophical way of being that is Ubuntu. And Ubuntu simply means I am because you are. It is an expression of our humanness in the South African sense. And it's found across the whole continent. It's also found in Asia, in Confucianism as Rin. And so each, what we would call indigenous way of knowing, has a concept of humanness. And this is the South African concept. And essentially what it tells us is that you are born human, but you're not born a human being, but that comes, your humanness and your beingness comes in relationship with other humans who are being. And so it's a relational philosophy that says, you know, you are the best reflection of me, which is a little scary, taken in a Western context, right?
Yeah, sure.
And so what it really does is it focuses our attention away from what we've come to talk about in the West as the static I, as an individual, right? And it focuses on the communal, on the wholeness of all of us, both as an individual and as a body. And so the beauty about Ubuntu to me is that it doesn't ever ask you to rid yourself of your individuality. But it asks you to take account of your individuality in context of community, which helps you to reframe essentially your value system, right? So it's not always about you, although you don't lose your I-ness, is what I call it. But your focus is on the we and how your I-ness fits into the.
And you mentioned this as an indigenous perspective, and indigeneity, I noticed, comes up a few times in your text. I feel like that is really critical at this moment in history, that we start to listen more to indigenous voices. In the West, I feel like the West, as we call it,
The political West,
the so-called West, is probably the peoples of the world who've most lost touch with their indigeneity, right, with their indigenous perspective. I don't know if you're familiar, but I've been interested in kind of neo-paganism for a long while because I see it as an attempt to try to rediscover the indigenous perspectives of the West. But it's tough because the alienation is so deep there. So you have a lot of, you spend some time in your text kind of engaging in a critique of the Western tradition, the Western intellectual tradition, if we can call it that, but also finding some points of consonance within that tradition, with consonance with Ubuntu, consonance with Buddhism, and you're finding there, can you tell us about some of those points of consonance in particular? Because I've noticed them as well, and people don't always even identify that you know, other people understand this in other parts of the world.
Well, it's a very, so one of my, before we go into how they come together, so one of my critiques of the political West, as we'll call it, is that we think we came up with all of this on our own, right? There is a lack of looking back or of valuing indigenous knowledge. And we see this even within our native communities here in the U.S. We don't, it's like, no, they have nothing to offer, which is completely incorrect. And so the one of those things is that I'm trying to get at in the book is that this knowledge existed before this thing called America was here, before this thing called the West was even invented, before Enlightenment, before Christ even. These knowledges were here. And I often have a conversation, I had a conversation here in the office with someone, and they said, well, you know, I'm a Christian, how can I believe in Ubuntu? I said, well, no one asked you to believe in it. And no one asks you to be a Buddhist. But the beauty about Buddhism is that you can practice Buddhism alongside any of your root religions. Buddhism is a spirituality. It's a way of being. It's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be your religion. I said, well, I don't know about that. And I said, well, let me be clear. As a people, as a species, we've been around for a long time. How old is Christ? I said, well, around 2,000 years. So how do you think your ancestors, these people who happen to be African-American, survived before this God-man was created? And so it's always like, oh, okay. It causes people to think, right? And it's like, listen, I don't know why I went off on that tangent, but we understand these knowledges have value, and they have sustained us as human beings and as communities for millennia. And that's what we have to go back to. So there was something working there to say that I am the descendant of an African who existed, you know, 5,000 years ago. That's something, it's not anything to scoff at.
Indeed. And one of the first things that kind of leapt out at me about this text is that you're writing often tackling some heavy intellectual issues, but at the same time, from a very, there's kind of a passion that's motivating the work, a concern for humanity, for where we are right now, for some of the challenges that we face. And that really comes through. So there is a real energy in the text, I find. And you're there. There's a first person presence from the get-go. So it's also personal at the same time as it's dealing with some challenging concepts. So we're talking about this critique of the Western tradition and kind of the mess that we're in, and in particular in higher education, how I believe it's not too strong to say how we failed to live up to some very high ideals, some or the best that we could be. Is that correct?
Oh, that's totally correct. Yeah. So higher education can't help to be but a microcosm of the larger society, right? And so if there are issues within institutions, then there are issues within society, because the issues within those institutions mirror the larger issues within society. And one of, for me, the beauties of Ubuntu is a beautiful Steve Biko quote. Steve Biko was a South African freedom fighter who was murdered in that struggle. And he says that it's the African people of the world, even in the diaspora, who will give the world a more human face. That the West, the political West, is always has always been concerned with militaristic power and with imperialism, right? But it is Africa that will give the world a more human face. And so that struck me, especially in terms of the mess we now find ourselves in, right? Which is, I go back to that phrase over and over again. We are in a mess. And Shakespeare had a beautiful quote that I think I use in the book, if I remember correctly. It's, what does he say? Hell must be empty because all the devils are here. And it's like, oh my goodness, it feels that way. Now, is that the absolute truth? No. Are we going through a period of time that we've never seen before? Perhaps not. When I talk to older generations of African Americans, they say, live long enough, right? We've been through this once. We got through it. We'll get through it again. These are hiccups in history.
Right. Well, that's a very good point, because I know a lot of people just in the last couple of years have become very worked up and concerned, and rightly so. But I am thinking in terms of the longer view, you know, that we have some longer, deep-seated issues and problems. One, again, just skimming through this text, one passage which particularly struck me was your description of the Western higher education milieu can only be described, if I may quote, as an economic epistemological regime of fear, where neoliberal ideology and market-driven educational discourse shapes and restricts thinking, and institutions of higher education are suppliers of consumer-driven demand. Not institutions of higher learning, but supermarkets of economical knowledge acquisition. Well, that's, okay, first of all, that's some powerful stuff, right? But clearly, that didn't just happen, you know, with the most recent presidential election.
Oh, goodness, no.
Right? Yeah. But it's not all darkness and despair in this text. So just a few pages later,
of course,
you also say, perhaps it is the teacher / professor who has the most responsibility in the world. More than the president of the United States? That, is, to me, is a message of, it's kind of awe-inspiring to contemplate. I can see the defense for that, but perhaps you'd like to make that case for our listeners, because a lot, you know, mostly our listeners are that person.
So there is a belief, and I think it may be Heidegger who says this, who's complicated in his own right, right? But he says that education shapes our very being in the world. And so when we think back, think about our president, and think about his own education. You know, we can then sort of suss out the root cause, right? Of course, you know, familial connections go into that, and societal connections and all of those things, and value systems. But perhaps if he were educated differently, he may have a different understanding of the world. That's how powerful education is. You are literally shaping the being of your students in the classroom. In higher education, in K-12, it's an ongoing project. And so you know, that the last piece for me is almost a reminder to educators that what you are doing is critical and it's serious and it's not to be taken lightly. Even if society takes you lightly, you know the weight of the mission that you have in your classroom could be the next president, right? And so think about what you're teaching, not only in terms of the curriculum, but in terms of modeling kindness, modeling empathy, modeling compassion. You know, students, of course, they're taking in the knowledge, but what they're really doing is taking you in. And they're taking in how you interact with other human beings and how you interact with them. And they carry that forward.
Well, again, a lot of our listeners are going to be faculty or teachers in higher education.
Yeah.
What would you hope that they would get out of this book? Or why should they read it? Why should they engage in the text? Hopefully they're hearing this podcast and they're a little bit interested.
Yeah.
What would you say to them to encourage them to actually read?
Yeah. That's a good question, Bart. As Bart said, the book is a bit heavy. It's a bit thick in its writing. That's on purpose because the goal is to disrupt your normal way of thinking. And so there are passages that you have to go back and read 2 or 3 times, and that's on purpose. If you struggle with the text, I think you will struggle with the text, right? And in that struggle, there could be some growth, or there could be some disagreement. But either way, for me, you've heard it and you can't unhear it, or you've read it and you can't unread it. And so in some ways, that seeps into your way of being. Either consciously or unconsciously. I think for teachers, professors, educators, for administrators, it sets up a different way of looking at the work that we do outside of the normal narrative that we hear every day about what it means to be an educator. We no longer hear or talk about education as vocation or about teaching as a vocation, right? This is a gift that you are receiving and that you're giving. And if we look at it that way, then it becomes a more precious endeavor. It also helps in the ontoeducational philosophy that it develops at the end of the book to reestablish the classroom as a communal space. Right? I don't believe in, or I don't hold this notion that there are actual experts. Right, knowledge is always changing. We're always becoming. It's a perpetual process. You may have a little more knowledge than I do. That just means you're the chief learner among learners, right? And that's how I set up a classroom. And it's that we are learning together. And every time we go back over a text or rediscover something else, it is a communal act. And it's a gift that we're giving and that we're receiving all the time. And so to set up a classroom in that way, or to enter a classroom in that way, really changes the power dynamics of a classroom, right? And it really calls on the students to also be actively engaged in the knowledge acquisition process, in the learning process, and not only to learn, but to teach. And so it's a very different way of looking at how we do education, and it's very different than the way we were educated, right? There was a teacher who stood in the front of the room. We said, you know, they said ABC, we said ABC. They said 2 times 2 is 2. We believed them that 2 times 2 is 2. It's not 2, it's 4. I'm misspeaking. but it could be 2 in some other world because it's all made up. But we have this, if we walk into the room thinking that we have the power and that we are the source of the power, then what does that do to our students? They are going to reify that in their own lives, right? Or they're going to feel less empowered. And the goal is that power circulates, and it should circulate in the classroom.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading the text myself. So Thank you for that. You know, I've had the feeling, the deep-seated feeling, that we need change, that yes. we need to change our way of doing things as classroom teachers, mm-hmm. as an institution, as a society.
Yeah.
And it isn't always clear to me exactly, you know, what changes are needed.
Mm-hmm.
So this book, I think, brings some, I believe, brings some deep perspective,
yeah.
some clarity
yeah.
on the nature of those changes. So,
yeah.
and adding some real depth mm. to that perspective. So I'm looking forward to engaging that. Shifting gears, though, it kind of, speaking of institutional
yeah.
change, you are involved with some interesting institutional changes that are going on right here at Xavier University
yes.
with potential impacts beyond the campus.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the new center?
Yeah, of course. So I'm the founding director, thanks to our Provost Ann McCall and President Ronald Durrett, of the Center for Equity, Justice, and the Human Spirit here at Xavier. And it is a really, really cool undertaking. I'm very excited about it. So what it is for us, it will serve as a space where folks can come together to have difficult conversations. It will serve as an anchor for our commitment to a more just and humane society throughout every discipline across the institution, throughout every interaction with students. You know, our hope is that we can put knowledge out into the world that will enhance folks' understanding of equity, enhance folks' understanding of justice, and help to eradicate or lessen some of those things that vex the human spirit, which is much needed today. So the center will serve as a research and policy institute, a place where we will help to eradicate systemic inequities. It will also serve as a place where community can come in for leadership building and human development trainings and workshops. And finally, as a place where we can enact or catalyze some institutional and cultural change.
Fantastic. And I can, to me, it seems abundantly obvious that this work flows directly out of the work you've done in this book, in writing this book.
Yeah.
You care to speak to those connections or
yeah.
how those connections are going to be made more manifest in
yeah.
in the center itself?
Yeah, that's really, it's a good connection, Bart. It is. So again, going back to community building and deepening our humanity. So the crux of the book is that education is a means by which we deepen our understanding of our shared humanity. That's the crux of it.
Mm-hmm.
Through these philosophical practices. The same can be said for the center. That this center is a way we understand our connectedness, our interconnectedness, and our shared humanity. In the context of the academic disciplines, in the context of policy, and in the context of how we build, maintain, tear down, rebuild systems.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's very much in flux, very much in progress. So we're catching you, I feel like, at a very interesting time.
Yes, yes.
Maybe in a year or so, we can come back and maybe by then I'll have read the book and things will have progressed with the center and so forth. So maybe we could have another conversation down the road.
I'd love that.
But right now, you know, like, what are the next steps? What's happening right now? And in particular, what do Xavier faculty need to know
yeah.
is happening
yeah.
Right now?
So we are in, the center was announced in August. We're now
2018.
We're now in November of 2018. So it's a 3-month-old center. So we'll take the next semester to sit down with internal community stakeholders and external community stakeholders to develop a way forward over the next 2 to 3 years, right? We understand that this is a very large undertaking.
Yes.
And we want to make sure that we can make the greatest impact in whatever area we decide to focus on for the greatest number of people. which is what we're doing next semester. So it's sitting down, planning, that's our goal next semester. Now, programmatically, one of the things that I'm working on is a community building for the institution, a community building undertaking, I guess we can call it that. So we will be hosting meetings for faculty, staff, students, and alumni to talk about what it means to be a Xavierite, to talk about what it means to be a human being, to talk about what it means to be an educated person in the world, to talk about what it means to be a man or woman with others. And so the end goal, we hope, of this process that will take place over the course of the spring semester will be a Xavier commitment to community statement or a value statement that simply says that when you're on this campus and if you wear the seal of a Xavierite, these are the things that we believe and hold dear to us as a community. So that's that will start when we come back in January. So be on the lookout for that. And the other thing that we're doing now, along with the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development, is our Blessing and the Burden series.
Right. That's been a discussion. We've had three meetings so far, and you've kind of served as a coordinator, facilitator for those discussions, really inviting people to talk about the experience of faculty of color on this campus, a historically black college, but a unique institution.
Yes.
So what's been your perspective on those conversations, where they've gone and where they're leading?
Yeah. I think the conversations have been very fruitful. You know, I think it's Toni Morrison who says that when children walk into a room, all they're looking for is if your eyes light up, if they've been seen. And so these conversations for me, not calling faculty children, but these, I think this is a human thing, right?
Sure.
I think these conversations for me have been very eye-opening in the fact that some of our faculty don't feel seen in the most basic way you need to be seen on this campus. And those are institutional issues at large, and those are issues in higher education in particular, right? So this is part of that, that very lovely quote you read about fear and all of that good stuff, market-driven and all of that stuff, right?
Sure.
Where faculty and students become data points, right? And the moment we make someone data, we dehumanize them. We see this. I had a really lovely argument when I was in graduate school with a speaker who came to LSU, who referred to a particular community in Baton Rouge by their zip code, never by their name, right? And we're in a huge auditorium, and of course, I just can't get it. I'm like, don't say anything. So I raised my hand and said, well, who are the people in that zip code? I said, well, I don't know. This is their demographic. I said, but who, name a person in the zip code that you know. And he couldn't name anyone. And I said, you know, what you've just done is you have dehumanized, you've taken away their humanity by giving them, by assigning them a number. So I don't think I've done that at all. I said, what did the Nazis do? And sort of, you can't say that to me. And I said, well, I just did. But that's exactly what they did, right? To make possible what they did, they had to dehumanize the people they murdered. And they tattooed a number on them. They no longer had a name. And so I don't know where I went with that, Bart, but anyhow, it's a
well, I know where I'd like to go with it. Because you bring me back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, the critique of the Western intellectual tradition, if you will. Sometimes people say, you know, you're talking about people being data points.
Yeah.
But of course, we value data, right?
Yeah.
Right? We want to be, we want our decisions to be informed by evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned this critique of the Western intellectual tradition, including science and technology and so forth. But of course, we use technology and we understand the benefits of science.
Right.
So sometimes I believe that when we raise these critiques, we're subject to a counter-criticism that, well, you're anti-West, you're anti-science, you're anti-evidence, and so forth. In fact, I've even heard it said, I can't remember the guy's name, that that people at this with this perspective hate the West, you know? And I have my own idea of how to respond to that, but I'm curious to know what you would say to people who would accuse you, maybe, or who would accuse critics of the Western intellectual tradition. Do you hate the West?
No, of course not.
Do you hate science?
I don't hate science. I don't hate the West, and I don't hate science.
That's good news for the large science departments that we have here on our campus, right? So can we reassure any listeners out there who might be having qualms or just kind of wondering, well, what's the relationship then?
So I don't hate the West, and I don't hate science. What I do dislike is that we have taken out the humanity in both. That's what I dislike. You know, the West, as we the political West, as we understand it, right, is a big hallucination. And so there's a wonderful quote I read the other day, and it says that, that reality is a one hallucination that we all agree upon. Right? That's it. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And so if we are hallucinating in this way, right, then we can take another pill and trip some other way and rethink how we've been doing this. Because we're hallucinating doesn't mean that it's the right hallucination. And so what I want people to think about is a different way. And it doesn't mean that you throw the whole thing out, although sometimes I think you throw the whole thing out. But think about how we can do this differently while recognizing the humanity of the people that you study, of the people that you interact with, of the people that are in your general vicinity, right? I think it's Maya Angelou who says, you know, if you walk into a room and don't say hello to me, that is one way of dehumanizing me, right? If you pass by me in a hallway and don't say good morning, you've just dehumanized me. And so think about that in terms of our dealings with students. Think about that in terms of our dealings with the cleaning staff on campus. Think about that in terms of our dealings with the checkout person at the supermarket. Right? These are very simple things that show that you see me as a human being, and I'm not a piece of technology that is being put to use for your service. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Pure instrumentality.
Right.
Sure. Well, and that brings us back to Ubuntu. The Ubuntu perspective could inform how we do science, how we look at data, right? Basically, how we go about our business. That's the point of the book, I think.
That's the point of the book.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading it. Thank you so much for your time, David. I should mention to any of our listeners, if you enjoy this conversation, you know, you should subscribe to the podcast on whatever your platform is. Is it iTunes or Google Play or what have you? Give us a rating. Give us a review. That does help people, you know, find the podcast, of course. And is there any, I guess, David, I just should say thank you.
Thank
you for your time. And thank you, really, for the work that you're doing here for higher education, both at Xavier and just kind of in general.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Love that.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu.
That's C-A-T dot X-U-L-A.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.